Centerpoint Church, who are we? We are the people of God, called out from the world, chosen by the Father, redeemed by the Son, being transformed by the Spirit, and journeying together to the day when the rule of God covers the earth. Believe that? Why do we say that each week? We've been saying it now each week for several months. And it might be good for us to pause just for a moment and think about that. We like to say this together because, indeed, it tells us of our identity. It tells us who we are. And in a world that tells us that you're a nobody or you're really important or you're just a consumer for the mall, this is a statement that reminds us the truth of who we really are. We say it because it places us in a story. God's grand story, looking from all the way back at the beginning to the present and where we're going to go in the future. We say it because it says something about us. We are the people of God. It's one thing to say, I'm a child of God, and that's a good thing. But how wonderful it is to remind ourselves every week that we are together, the people of God, called out from the world. And one other reason, why do we say it weekly? Well, it's interesting. It's those things that we repeat that really become part of us. And our hope is that as we say this statement, it goes deeper and deeper into who we really are, so that our identity really is formed, and we believe more deeply than ever we are the people of God. So there's reason for that. I trust you come desiring for that same kind of identity. I do a lot of commuting. I travel each day, usually from my house in Mesquite downtown, and then I have several other things that I have to connect with across the Metroplex through the weeks. And I have always thought that the fastest way between two points was a direct line. You know, the shortest way is usually going to be the fastest way. But I've recently discovered a wonderful new app that I use on my smartphone, and many of you might use it as well. If you've talked with me, you know I'm quite enthused about this app. It's called Waze, W-A-Z-E. Waze is an application made for commuters like me. And it will tell me that the best way to get from point A to point B, it's not always the shortest route. Now, I have certain routes that I like to take on my normal commutes, and I kind of know which ones are the most direct. But every once in a while, I'll start Waze in the morning. Actually, it starts me. It says, are you on your way to work now? And I will say yes, and it will compute a route for me, and it will say, oh, today I'm going to take you, and it's a very much longer route in terms of miles. And I think, I'm not sure I can trust this thing. I mean, let me just take my normal route, the most direct route. What could be wrong with that? Surely not much bad can happen if I just take my normal route. I think that perhaps our decisions and the spiritual part of life are not unlike what happens when we think about getting to our destination using a GPS. We find ourselves looking to pursue in the most direct way possible the very blessings of God. We want peace, security, justice. And we think the best way to get there is just the fastest, most efficient, let's go directly there. But then we recognize that sometimes God in His Word gives us pathways that don't seem very direct. In fact, He'll make us wait. And wait, and wait. And we wonder perhaps, well, what would happen if I just take the most direct route to God's blessings? It wouldn't be all that bad, would it? Take, for example, what it would be like to pursue a blessing of security. Most of us like that. We believe that God would have us give us a sense of security, and so we pursue it in perhaps the most direct ways possible. For example, we would save money and perhaps buy extra insurance and sock away a little bit extra for retirement because we want a sense of security. When we're purchasing a car, we might get one that has really high cash crash protection ratings so that if our family's in an accident, well, we'll be secure in that. We might try to make sure we have a home security system that's really robust so that when we punch in that keypad and set it in the day, our house is going to be protected and we will be secure. Those are all really nice, fast, direct ways, it would seem, to pursue security. It may not even seem bad. But we wonder, what's so wrong about taking them in light of what God has given us with his role as our protector and provider of security? This morning, we want to ask that very question about when we're in this process of pursuing faster, more efficient ways, what happens when we take shortcuts to God's blessing? What will be the results when we indeed take shortcuts and try to pursue God's blessings in our lives that he plans to get us, perhaps without waiting for him? We're going to do that by looking at a story from Israel's history where they did just that thing. They had the blessings of God in front of them, and they took shortcuts. They decided to find a more direct route than what God really had for them. And in that process of unpacking what they were tempted to do, we'll find that God warns them. And then we'll look at the response to their warning. So their temptation, the warning, their response, and then our response. What do we learn from how Israel encountered this shortcut for God's blessing? What happened when Israel tried to get God's blessing? Well, here's what happened. They were looking for the security of They were looking for the blessing of God's security. They were looking to be able to stay in the land. They were looking to be able to have military victory. And they wanted the most certain, sure way they could get it. And they were afraid it would be yanked from them. We see what happens in this story in 1 Samuel chapter 8. So if you'll turn there with me, I invite you to consider with me the situation where indeed Israel seeks a shortcut to God's blessing. And they do this by replacing God's methods with worldly ways. Israel will seek God's blessing by replacing God's methods with worldly ways. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. I want you to see how they are going to pursue these blessings of justice and security. Chapter 8, verse 1 says this: "When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as Israel's leaders," or actually judges. "The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not follow his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice." Stop there for just a second. So here's the situation. Samuel's getting old, and he's been serving as judge in Israel, the one who would bring justice. And the way the time was set up was that these judges would be in different parts of the country in order to guide the people in the ways of the Lord and even provide victory over enemies. As Samuel grew old, he lived in the north, and so he knew it was time to put his sons as judges way in a city in the far south called Beersheba. They were separated by many, many miles. And then the word came, "Your sons, they're perverting justice. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing as judges. In fact, it is a serious problem where their appointment actually shows that they were denying justice to people just like Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas. Justice was blocked. Did you notice it there in verse 3? It says, they turned aside after dishonest gain, accepted bribes, and perverted justice. Literally, they took bribes. They took money for themselves. And this is an indirect contradiction to what the law had said back in Deuteronomy chapter 16, where it says, do not accept bribes. Judges, you must not take bribes. Because if you do, you'll be booted up out of the land. If the judges accept bribes, Israel will be cast out of the land. This is bad. Because if we have judges who accept bribes, we're going to lose our place in the land. This isn't just about getting justice because we want justice in the land. It even threatens our very existence here. In fact, as the text goes on, we get the impression that the way these men are described is they're described just like Hophni and Phinehas. Hophni and Phinehas, you remember, they were the men who were sons of Eli. And what did they do? Well, back in chapter 2, they took boiled meat. They took it for themselves, and they take it by force when they can't get it. What do these men do? Same word. They take bribes. And the author is connecting these two sons of Samuel with the two sons of Eli. Now, why is that important? Remember what happened when the two sons of Eli were in power, Hophni and Phinehas? Israel got wiped out. When they were around, the Lord fought against Israel. So certainly the idea here is if these two sons of Samuel are around, if Eli and if the two sons of Samuel, Joel and Abijah come, and they're like the sons of Hophni and Phinehas, maybe the same thing will happen. We're going to die. We can't have this. So clearly there's a problem. We want justice. We want security. What will Israel do about it? And here's the temptation. Here's where the temptation comes. Because what they're going to do is choose a worldly solution, a worldly way. Chapter 7, verses 4 and 5, or 8, chapter 8, verses 4 and 5. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "You're old, and your sons do not follow your ways. Now, appoint a king to judge us, such as all the other nations have." Give us a king, a new leader, someone who's not just a judge, someone who can unify our nation, someone who can build for us chariots and put an army in place, and someone who can make us strong like the other nations. We want to be able to defend ourselves and attack like the other nations. Give us not some judge. Give us a king who, literally, will judge over us so that we might be like the other nations. This is choosing a worldly way to pursue God's blessing. It's a shortcut. It's a shortcut. You see, God had said to Israel that they were going to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, a nation set apart from all the other nations, a nation distinct. They would not be like their pagan neighbors in any way because God would be their king, and they would be distinct from their neighbors. And so for them to say at this point, "Give us a king like the other nations," is to choose the ways of the world to pursue the blessings of God. Can you imagine? Here we are, people who are basically saying, we would rather live like a pagan nation than have the administration that God had set up over us. They were tempted to use worldly ways to pursue their blessings. A shortcut. When they would replace the rule of God with the methods of the world. I suggest that we're tempted in similar ways. If you're a parent, or even if you're a kid and you've used this little line on your parents, you know exactly what it's like. "But Dad, everyone's doing it. Mom, all my friends are going there." As if the way the world does things is the way we ought to pursue it. We have these temptations. We're tempted, for example, as a student who in school wants to get good grades in order to have a sense of security, in order to graduate, in order to get a good job. And so those are all really good desires, desires for things that God might bring as blessings. And so what does the student do? Well, He splits his work with another student and another student, and they all kind of get together, and they provide answers for one another, and somebody might even have access to a test from last year or last semester. And, you know, everybody does it that way. It's okay. And the teacher doesn't even seem to mind. The teachers all know about it. It's just all right. Yeah. Tempted to pursue a worldly way, a shortcut to God's blessing. Or there's a girl who really wants a husband. She wants to be married, and she wants the security of a permanent relationship. What a blessing from God that would be. And so she watches as her friends all seem to get husbands. And what they do is they just flirt a little bit. They wear some clothing that's just a little bit more provocative. They send a few tweets that just are a little more sexy oriented. And it works. They all find their guys. Tempted to take a shortcut to God's blessing. Well, for some of us, it's at the office, because we'd love to have a promotion. We'd love to be recognized for our work so that we might, in fact, have a little higher status and a little more money and a little bit more security. In fact, we might even deserve it, but we recognize that the way that people get promoted at our office is, well, it's by brown nosing. You know, it's playing that political game where you say extra compliments to the boss and you give her a few extra gifts and you put down your coworkers. It's political posturing. It's the way the world does it. What could be so bad about that? It's a shortcut. And we're tempted. This week I was looking for a used car for one of my family members, and we need to find another vehicle. And I found myself scouring the internet for good deals. And one of the first things I wanted to do was find out, hey, what's the crash test rating for these cars? You know, and you can find them now. They're ranked by front test, front crash, side passenger crash, rear end crash. Because I want to be protected. I want my family protected. And if I get the right kind of car, a temptation to pursue protection in the world's ways, the world's methods. When we do that, when we take a shortcut to God's blessing, what do we get? What are the results when we try to exchange God's methods for worldly ways? What the text is going to show us is that we get just what we deserve. We get just consequences. When we exchange God's methods for worldly ways to pursue God's blessings, we will get just consequences, just what we deserve. This happened to Israel, for indeed, in Israel's situation, they're going to ask for a king, and God's going to give them a king, and they'll get all the oppression that comes with it. We're back in our text in 1 Samuel chapter 7. And we break in at verse 6. Sorry, I said 7. It's chapter 8. We're in chapter 8 today. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 6. But when they said, "Give us a king to judge us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, "Listen to all the people are saying to you. It's not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day that I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now, listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will literally reign over them will judge with his judgments, will claim as his rights, as his justice." We'll stop here. The text gives us four stabs at the what the text is doing is saying that this is the standard operational procedure for Israel rejecting God, forsaking him. Did you see it? The language there in verse 7. They're rejecting me. They're not just choosing a king. They're forsaking me, Samuel. That's what God says to him in verse 8. It's what they've always done. God brought them out of Egypt, and what did they do? They said, "Hey, take us back to Egypt, Moses." They didn't have enough meat, they thought. So they said, "Hey, God's arm is too short to give us meat to eat." Later on in their journeys, they would say, let's get rid of Moses. He can't lead us. Moses went up on the mountain and stayed too long. And they said, hey, give us a golden calf. We reject this God as our king. It's a history of rejecting Yahweh as their king. And the Lord looks at this and he says, this is the way these people act. Verse 9 is really the key out of this section where it says, literally, listen to their voice, but only with warning, warn them about the justices and judgments of the king who will reign. The justice is going to come. You want justice, Israel? I'm going to give you justice right through your king. And here is what it will look like. So God now explains this warning of justice, and it's going to come in the form of oppression on their family, on their crops, on their livestock. Look at verse 10. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, this is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights, or literally will bring as his justice. This is what he will do to show you how he judges. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses. They will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants, your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys. He will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. You yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you've chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. You want a king? You want to shortcut God's blessings, Israel? Then you will experience severe oppression from the king that you will choose. So severe, God will not deliver you from it. If you were watching closely, you saw four different stabs at the severity of this opposition, how great it is. Notice the kinds of things that this are going to be given up for this king: family, crops, livestock. Why are those things mentioned? Those are actually the very blessings that God said he would give under the covenant. Blessings of family, crop, livestock. You're going to give them up to this king. Did you notice how often he says the king's going to take and take and take and take? In fact, there are at least four instances in this text where the author emphasizes that this king is going to be a taker of your things. You know what Hophni and Phinehas did? They were takers of the meat. Do you remember what Samuel's sons were described as? Takers of bribes. You want a king? I'll give you a king. He'll be a taker, just like the people you're trying to avoid. This will be severe oppression. God says not only will you lose your blessings, not only will the king take them, but notice the language he uses. He says he's going to take a tithe, a tenth. Where should that go? That's the portion that goes to the Lord. You can't give the tithe to the Lord and a tithe to the king. You give them the one or the other. And so God says, this is a king who will compete with what is rightfully mine. This is severe oppression. And then the final result, as we mentioned in verse 17, you'll be slaves or vassals to this king. That was to be the position of Israel before Yahweh, that he was to be their king and they were to be his servants, his slaves. They were to be, it's the same word used elsewhere in the Old Testament to describe the relationship of them as vassals to their sovereign king. No, you'll now have that relationship to this king you choose. You see, it's a complete exchange of what king would rule over them. How did Israel respond? Well, despite that severe warning, they said, "Give us the king." Look at it. It's a sad word in verses 19 through 22 as we finish up the chapter. But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No. No. No, they said. "We want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." Imagine. That was God's position, who would go out before them in battle. That was God's position to raise up judges. That was God's position to fight for them. Yisrael, God fights for them. "We want someone else to fight for us," they say. Verse 21. When Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. And the Lord answered, "Listen to them and give them a king." Samuel said to the Israelites, "Everyone go back to your own town. Their king is going to come." God punishes Israel by letting them have exactly what they want, and they will reap the consequences. The text is written as a warning for the readers, a warning that says, if you seek your shortcuts to God's blessing, rather than waiting on God's king, there will be just consequences. Expect it. Still true today? Is it possible? Perhaps seeking a better grade in high school by the world's ways, you can get a better grade. It just might work. But now you're a slave to the other students, with reciprocal favors expected of you. And there's an oppression that you never anticipated. Seeking a husband by the world's ways, by putting up a false you, it'll work. And the just consequences could be that you're enslaved to this new identity that you have to prop up. This new you that you have to feed to a new relationship to keep it going. You'll be a slave for the rest of your life. Or maybe it's seeking that promotion by brown-nosing and political posturing, and the just consequences are that from now on, as long as you're employed in that place, you'll be enslaved to this game of political posturing to be accepted. There are consequences to taking shortcuts. That's the error. That's the reality of the relationship. What response does God want from us? If this is true, if in fact there are really no shortcuts to God's blessing, then clearly what he wants from us is to pursue his blessing through his king, not through worldly ways. Pursue his blessing through his king, not through worldly ways. And he's given us a king. We have a king, one who has come and said his kingdom is not of this world. He does not employ the means and methods of this world to bring us God's blessings. He is the protector and the healer, as we have said. I'm not sure what is happening. Thanks, Ronnie. Let's see if that helps. There we go. Maybe I won't bump it anymore. Okay. Our challenge is to pursue security and justice only through our King and not through the world's ways. So I've developed a few habits along this line. I don't have it all figured out, but here's some of the things I've been trying to do. Every day I go to my security system at my house. You may have one too, or you've got a key on your door, I'm sure, for locking your door or locking your car. And as I punch in those buttons, I do this. Dear Lord, I thank you that you are the protector of this house. Punch, punch, punch. Will you please protect it today? I save for retirement. Many of you are as well. You're saving and you're investing in funds and retirement policies and insurance policies. And it's tempting to think when I start looking at those balances and adjusting my investments that I am going to be the source of security, or that they're going to be my source of security. And now when I open that software, I say, Lord, you are the source of my security. Thank you for securing my life. My security is not in this stash of stuff. When we go to the doctor, we're tempted to think, oh, this doctor, this medical community is really the ones who are going to guarantee and ensure my health and well-being. That's the way the world pursues health. Perhaps as we go to the doctor, we recognize that we do this not just because, not in the way that the world does it, as if all our hope is in a medical community. We do it with the hope and the acknowledgement that our King is the provider of health. We long for justice in our land, a society where indeed people will be treated rightly and fairly. And so we work hard, perhaps, to try to figure out, well, should I vote Democrat? Should I vote Republican? Should I vote something else? Who is the person who's going to lead us to justice and security in this land? We vote. And we vote with a prayer that indeed God will bring justice in our land through whomever takes the office of president. As a church, you know, we could be very tempted to pursue the world's ways to see our church grow. We want God's blessing. We want people coming to hear the gospel. We want people coming here and growing in the grace and knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. It'd be very easy for us to put together slick advertising, to put together the really cool websites. We could go out and hire an MBA from Harvard who has all kinds of business knowledge and efficiency, and we would be more efficient, and we would be more appealing, and we could do better with promotion, just like the world does. All those things could be used, but never with a reliance upon them, as if that is what will bring our growth. We look to our King to grow his church. He is the source of our help. He is the source of our blessing. You'll notice that none of these things are wrong. Doctors aren't wrong. Investments aren't wrong. Security systems aren't wrong. Crash tests are not wrong. Asking for a King was not wrong, except that when it replaces a trust in God, now it's rejection of the King. That's wrong. But we are people who do not want to go that path. We want to be people who pursue God's blessing through God's King, not by worldly ways. And so, our Father, we would ask that you would indeed help us to be committed to pursuing justice, security, peace, all of your blessings from your hand. For some of us, we've never really followed you as our King. Lord, I would ask that on this day, for those of us who have really never known the King, that on this day, my friends in this room would turn their lives over to you as their King to pursue King Jesus. Father, we recognize that the normal routes, the shortest routes, are not always the best. May we choose yours. And so with the hymn writer, we would ask that you would be our vision, that we may seek our blessings from you and not through our own conniving and manipulating. Thou and thou only, first in my heart, high King of heaven, my treasure, thou art.